Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, September 9th. There are various ways out of the coronavirus pandemic. There's vaccinating our way out, eventually, we hope, but certainly not yet. Suppressing our way out through intense and longer lockdowns like China and New Zealand. Infecting our way out through herd immunity like Sweden. And testing and tracing and quarantining our way out like South Korea and some other countries. None of these is perfect. But of them, testing and tracing might be the best cultural fit with American individualism and also the most ready to go technologically if only we could get our act together on fast and plentiful tests. Let's take a closer look at that with Dr. Atul Gawande, staff writer for The New Yorker, a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. His latest New Yorker article is called "We Can Solve the Coronavirus Test Mess Now If We Want To." Dr. Gawande, we so appreciate your time. Welcome back to WNYC.
Glad to be here.
You're right that we don't have a technological problem. We have an implementation problem. What do you mean by that?
Well, back in the early phases of the pandemic, we had a technological problem. We didn't have tests. And there was a good 2 to 3 month delay in approving tests and making it possible for laboratories to have get out there and test people. Now, today, our problem is not that we don't have tests. We have hundreds of laboratories approved to provide testing. I say it's an implementation problem because we have effectively 3 or 4 national labs that provide the vast majority of the testing, but there are lots of regional labs that have an enormous amount of untapped capacity. And I point to examples of, about 6 labs that would double the amount of U.S. capacity if we tapped into their capabilities. But it's sort of like having an electricity blackout in New York City, but finding that there are lots of other cities that have lots of supply and no electric grid to connect them. And that's the situation we have now.
So the current testing is done largely by these 4 giant vertical monopolies that you referred to as a group, and people know these names. They're Quest Diagnostics, LabCorp, BioReference Laboratories, and Sonic Healthcare. Is there any indication that those companies are ramping up testing ahead of the fall and winter seasons?
They are indeed ramping up testing. But, 4 labs, Quest and LabCorp, the 2 biggest, came out and said there is no way that they alone, those big labs, can manage the fall volume, let alone what we've hit in the summer, where you see people and still have people reporting a week or more delay in getting results back, which basically makes the results useless. So, what I point to, for example, one of these companies, Quest, for example, will have 175,000 tests they do per day. We have 2 laboratories with untapped capacity in Boston that have at least that much capacity available if we were to begin to tap into that kind of capacity. And then I point to, we do about 650,000 or 700,000 tests a day in the United States. We should be at roughly 3 times that. And we have that capacity around. Now, why does it not come to the table? Those labs, what makes Quest, LabCorp, and other places so effective is that they're not just laboratories that can process the test. They are big logistics operations that can collect the tubes and samples from all of the doctor's offices and testing locations. They can make sure they have the barcoding software and systems like that. They have, the shipping arrangements to move tests around the country nationally. We have not set up that basic public health infrastructure of being able to match capacity to need and have the interconnections to make it possible, but we can create that, and it's quite possible to create that. I started an alliance of 3 companies for doing it in New England, where all we did was made sure that the tubes could get shipped, a barcode could get put on them, a doctor's order could be there, and you could have a proper follow-up for people. And we've been able just in the last few weeks to bring on capacity in New England that's moving, you know, thousands of tests per day now, and it can become 10 times that in a few weeks more to come.
Wow. So to cut to the chase, you're right, we could have the testing capacity we need nationally within weeks.
Absolutely.
Compare us to a couple of other countries that you write about, other developed countries around the world that have met their testing needs. How does the United States compare to South Korea or England, two examples you cite, when it comes to testing, and what can we learn from them?
Yeah, basically the critical part of testing is that it should be easy to get. It should be free, so there are no barriers. I mean, we're economically constrained by how much virus we have, and making it so that testing is free should be feasible. It should be possible without a doctor's order. You shouldn't have to go get a clinic visit in order to and the charges for that in order to get the test. And then it should be at least within 48-hour turnaround time. Typically, it will be one-day turnaround time. South Korea is a great example of how they went about this. They had their first, and I described the timeline in the article, they had their first three cases by January 27. The government had one laboratory isolate the virus from those specimens. They notified labs and manufacturers that they're going to need coronavirus test labs and testing, and we need it as fast as possible. They then took the samples and created blinded, diluted test plates that had, and then shipped them to the labs as a kind of a final exam for whether your tests work. And within a week, 47 labs had gotten a perfect score on their tests, and they approved them to start testing. And so, you know, immediately you had capacity right in the very beginning of February. We didn't even start any process like that until mid-March, and never sped up the process to make that approval process happen. Now, at the same time, South Korea made sure that they had hospitals, clinics, and drive-through facilities. They had 600 sites that they opened up, and they made it possible to call the equivalent of 311 in New York, you know, 1339 in South Korea, anywhere in the country, and you could schedule a test near you that same day. And that meant you had several things. You had free sites where you could go get your tests. The scheduling process meant that they had a handle on where they were getting bottlenecks and backups on turnaround time, and then they could shift their labs, and it became, you know, over 100 labs that had availability. They could shift the supply so that they could make sure you still kept to a, you know, roughly one-day turnaround time. And it's very similar to that in England as well. Now, we have examples in different parts of the country where we've made that happen. We are capable of doing it. It really isn't rocket science. It's connecting the dots.
And we'll get into how all this would make it possible if we did connect those dots to go back to work, to go back to school, to open the businesses, to have normal life as we thought of it before. But let me ask you one sort of skeptical question about whether that really is the door to that. Since you're using Britain as an example, Britain is having a surge in cases right now, from what I read in the news just this morning. So how does that fit in with the fully available testing picture you were just painting actually leading to suppressing the virus?
Yeah, and any testing approach is going to be just part of the picture. You know, Donald Trump tweeted just in the last day or two about, you know, there being a surge of cases in New Zealand, which has been a poster child for doing it absolutely the right way. They had a surge of, you know, a dozen cases. Our surges are of thousands of cases. We have 51,000 college students who've tested positive so far just in the last 2 weeks. So, you know, the question is, how can you react to the surges? A, can you know that they've happened because you have enough testing to know where they are? B, are you able to implement the right procedures so you can contain it locally? you know, the steps we had in the early part of the infectious outbreak, we had the opportunity to do local level containment by testing and containing and tracing people. And, you know, we could have kept it to Seattle, San Francisco, a few entry points and snuffed it out. We did that. We saw that happen with Ebola. The next part, though, is when it spread more widely, we then needed to do national containment. We needed to use the lockdown to have deployed our testing and tracing capability, as well as, you know, testing and tracing alone won't do it. You got to wear masks, and Britain was late to adopting masks. We've actually done better in much of the U.S. than Britain has in adopting masks. They're only getting there now. So, you know, these are all factors that play in. Our basic problem is we've never decided to fight the virus. We have argued about fighting the virus. We've argued about whether it's just the flu, whether it's no big deal. But, you know, where on some of the locations like New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Massachusetts, we've taken it on and we've beat it back. And we're, you know, it's impressive that New York is now down to a test positivity rate below 1%. Right. There are still things we have to fix around our testing process. And we have much of the country where they're not committed to avoiding large gatherings and wearing masks. They don't have the consistent leadership the way that we've been following it in the Northeast.
And so last week in this country, we had an average of more than 800 deaths per day from coronavirus, whereas in the five Western European countries that we think of as in a group with us around the same population, they had under 100 deaths a day last week. It all adds up with the testing piece, the lack of will piece, the skepticism of science piece, all that stuff. Another piece of your article that introduces a phrase that I think people should know and would like to know is it's the phrase assurance testing. This is on people who don't have symptoms, but they would get testing that you characterize as assurance testing as important to stopping the spread. Can you talk about assurance testing?
Yeah. The basic level of testing that we absolutely need is that if you are sick with any symptoms, you should be able to go out and get diagnostic testing to diagnose what is going on with you. However, the next level, what you see is, you know, when the NBA goes into the bubble and has everybody testing every few days, that's assurance testing. That's so that people can get out and do things where, you know, the known practices of wearing a mask and maintaining social distancing, that works. But there are situations where you can't do that, where we want to resume normal human physical activity. So people are seeking testing to go visit an older relative. People are seeking testing to cross borders when they come from higher risk areas. They want to come to New York and be able to come in. And then also you have entire industries like the film industry that can't even run because you need to have people in close connection with one another, not wearing masks, talking, you know, music groups, symphony. There's so many human activities that need us to be able to be close together. And that only right now is possible while we await a vaccine with what can be termed assurance testing, meaning testing regularly enough that you can catch people at the moment that catch people to know whether they're cleared, not infected, and people can be safe to have those kinds of interactions.
So for that kind of testing, using the NBA example that you gave, where those professional athletes who are privileged enough to have access to being tested every other day have pretty much been able to run their playoffs without infecting anybody else. Even in Major League Baseball, where they're not in the bubble, they still can go out in the world if they follow, you know, certain safety protocols. They're getting tested every other day too, and the outbreaks have been very few and limited when they've occurred, except for one case that took place very early in the Miami Marlins. And so the reason I bring up I come back to your example of pro sports is the ease of testing that they are privileged to have. They get it every other day. Are we capable of developing a world where pretty soon, before we go to work every other day, before we go to school every other day, we test ourselves, and that level of assurance testing keeps the spread down. Because we certainly don't have that capacity, and neither do those labs, even in the network that you described, as they ramp up.
Well, I want to push on that. So Massachusetts, for example, our economy is deeply tied to education, colleges and universities. We have well over 100 universities that are bringing students back to campus. And we have a laboratory here that I reported on called the Broad Institute, which is an academic laboratory affiliated with MIT and Harvard, where, you know, when I visited them in July, they had 3,000 tests a day they did for our state. We have in our state, we're doing about 9,000 to 10,000 tests per day. And so they were a pretty big testing organization for our state, and they provided guaranteed overnight turnaround time. The reality was that in mid-July, they already had 35,000 tests a day of capacity that wasn't being tapped. And with a few weeks' notice, they could get up to 100,000 tests a day, which would be a sixth of the entire country's capacity in this one lab. Now, there are more than one in our area that has that kind of capacity. In order to bring the colleges and universities back, the Broad committed to supporting those labs to have testing, those universities, to have testing on at least a weekly, if not twice or more weekly basis. And as of yesterday, they were past 60,000 tests a day. They ramped up. They've provided it. They've lowered the cost dramatically. For the universities, it's around $25 a test instead of the $100 a test, plus logistics and everything else to run them. They're continuing to have overnight turnaround, and they still have more capacity. My alliance is bringing together smaller players, nursing homes, schools, and others, and providing the logistics so that lab can manage it and process it. This is possible, right? And it demonstrates, so we can make this happen for universities and colleges. The places we need to make this happen as well are nursing homes, places where you have essential workers or really high risk people, right. And then
prisons, meatpacking plants, things
completely.
Like that.
That's the phase we're in, and we're ready to be able to get to the place. You know, I start talking about some of the testing technologies where quicker, faster turnaround technologies are coming available that would allow you to begin to, you know, potentially have testing when you go to get an airplane flight or go in for a meal.
This is all very hopeful, what you're laying out about the colleges and the capacity in the Boston area. But does that mean all these people are going out to a lab somewhere every other day or twice a week?
No. So the way that it's organized is that, first of all, it's not the deep probe your brain swab, because the FDA has approved now that there's been demonstrated ability to do just inside the nose swabs. Mm-hmm. And then it's done in such a way that you swab your own nose under observation by a clinician. And so you can have a group of a dozen kids come up, grab the kit, swab while being observed, and then hand the kit off and send it off. And so you're able to get through large volumes of people with a small production operation all on campus, with the help of a nursing team.
That's big. I think we have a call about this from Duke in Jersey City. Duke, you're on WNYC with Dr. Atul Gawande. Hey there.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Okay. I was just going to mention, I was recently listening to Ralph Nader's show, and he had a doctor on there. The doctor's name was Michael Mena. He was an epidemiologist from the Harvard School of Public Health, and he was talking about this. He was talking about testing, like the doctor you have on now, and he was talking about this paper strip test that would be something similar to, like, you know, pregnancy tests that you can buy over the counter at Duane Reade or something like that. And he was saying how it could be available to everybody immediately, almost. Now, he wrote an op-ed in the Times, I think it was, about a week ago. So I was just wondering if your guest knows anything about that. And then my question is, This is like the most fundamental question to me about this whole COVID thing since March. I keep hearing from multiple sources that the accuracy of any of these tests, the PCR tests or the saliva tests, any of them can test positive for any COVID that you have ever had.
Duke, let me leave it there and get you some answers. And I know you're right about test reliability in your article, Dr. Gawande. So Duke is asking a few great questions there. What would you say?
Yeah, first of all, Michael Mina is actually my colleague at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Chan School of Public Health, and he's been an advocate of the idea that you can, in fact, have rapid antigen tests. So the tests that we were just describing earlier are molecular tests. They test for the genetic material in the virus. The antigen test tests for the protein in the virus instead of the RNA, and they are cruder tests, so they need a higher level of virus in order to detect that the person is infected. But Michael Mina makes the point that those are the people who are likely to be most contagious, that even though it is a less sensitive test, if you test every day with a cheap, fast test, that's better than testing infrequently with a test that has too long a turnaround time. And there's probably some truth to that. We haven't fully proven it all out, but we are just last week, Abbott came out with a 15-minute test card that's very much like what Michael Mina described. This doesn't require a machine. You take a swab, you put it into the test card, and you're able to see whether it's positive or negative. Now, it has to be run with a clinician who is certified to use it, because you have to run a positive control and a negative control. It's still a little bit complex. It's not quite as simple as a pregnancy test. But we're on our way to having, I've seen the actual pregnancy test equivalent, that manufacturing costs are as low as $5 per test, deploying it, making sure you get the positive results reported. There's a whole lot of operational stuff you have to put around it. But these are part of a whole armamentarium of technologies that are going to be available to us very quickly. And the key to it is distributing it and using it in the right way and knowing how to deal appropriately with the ways in which they are they can have higher inaccuracy rates in certain respects, but be powerful and beneficial in others.
One follow-up on that. Duke, the caller, said even the PCR tests, the deep nasal swab tests that we most commonly use now, can be unreliable. And I see that from your article, it can have a false negative rate of up to 20%. So you're right, that miss rate is even higher during the 4 days or so before symptoms begin. So are we testing a lot of people too quickly after they are exposed?
So when you're exposed, you like to test about 4 or 5 days after the moment you've been exposed. But a lot of the time, you never know when someone has been exposed. So, you know, what we know is when you've been tested, if it's negative, there's a possibility that there might have been a very low level of virus. And with a PCR test, you have about, you know, typically you'd say on average about 3 days that test, quote unquote, lasts, because the process of an infection with the coronavirus is that you will get infected on day one, and it takes time for the virus to multiply. And so you can miss it for those first 3 or 4 days. Then on the tail end, your immune system will take over, and you may have about a week to 10 days after symptoms that the virus will be beat back. And then after that, you may still test positive for a period while the dead virus is being cleared from your system. You're catching it during this whole phase when you go in for a single test. So being cleared for a test doesn't by a test doesn't mean that you're now, you know, totally fine for doing whatever for the next, you know, 2 weeks to come. You're sort of safe and cleared for a few days, which is why when you come into cross-border, for example, they'll ask you in Massachusetts, for instance, that you show that you had a negative test in the last 72 hours or have to quarantine if you came from a higher risk state.
Dr. Atul Gawande, staff writer for The New Yorker, a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. His latest New Yorker article is called "We Can Solve the Coronavirus Test Mess Now If We Want To." Thank you so much, Dr. Gawande. We really, really appreciate it.
Great to be on. Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.